Good morning. It's Friday, December 19th, 2014, and if you're counting, you have one day short of a week left till Christmas. Merry Christmas. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL, and I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And today we're going to bring you part two of our discussion of what life would be like in the United States without the Bill of Rights. And Gary Porter, the executive director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, is on the phone with us. And also in studio is Charles Proctor from the law office of Proctor in Lindsay. And this will be our panel today for our discussion on this. Now, of course, last Friday, we began our discussion about what the Bill of Rights. And believe it or not, there's a lot of folks out there that have heard about the Bill of Rights, and they go looking around for such a document to see Bill of Rights, and they never really find it. And keeps popping up are these amendments to the Constitution. Well, as you're learning, that the first 10 amendments of the Constitution are considered the Bill of Rights. And what those Bill of Rights do, lock in and cover a lot of things that the Constitution, the body of the Constitution itself, did not do. And that's what we're examining today. It's another thing that over the years has been taken for granted. Well, they're there. But if they weren't there, it's kind of like one of these shows, Life Without People. If they weren't there, what would this country be like? I'll give you a hint. Not good. Not good. So we're going to be going into that. But before we do, I do have to make an announcement for something that we've got coming up on January 10th
yes.
of 2015. Not far away, actually, is we are, well, there's be a Constitution seminar, the basics of the Constitution. And our own Gary Porter will be conducting this one-day seminar on the U.S. Constitution and talking about the document, starting the process, the have folks rediscover this document, understand the importance of this document in this great republic in which we live in. Now, there is a registration for that. The tuition for the Constitution seminar will be $30 until January 4th, where the price goes the $40 thereafter. And with the registration, with the seminar, there will be a continental breakfast that will go from 8 till 8:50. Then the seminar itself will begin, and there will be a lunch provided as well with that. And at the end, there will be a door prize as well. But you have to get in. You have to register for this. And to do so, you can give Susan Locke a call at 610-539-1783. Or you can email her at susan@1180wfyl.com.
Bruce, what did we say yesterday? That it would be a good Christmas present for someone, if you don't know, the gift of knowledge.
Yes,
you know?
Excellent idea. Excellent idea. Knowledge is power.
An ever-giving gift.
Yes. And like I said, knowledge is power. And you do hold the power in this country, ladies and gentlemen, because the document does start off referring to you, we the people. Now, this seminar will take place at the Conference Center at Valley Forge. And as I said, it's a one-day seminar that will take place on January 10th, 2015. Our own Gary Porter will be conducting it. And to enroll, you need to give Susan Locke a call. Let me give you that number again. It's 610-539-1783. Or the email is susan@1180wfyl.com. So, from this point on, we might as well get the discussion going. I think Gary's on the phone with us. Are you not, Gary? Are you there?
I am indeed, and that was a great prelude. Thanks for that.
I figure I'd give you a little plug there. You get things going. But I want to start off by wishing you a Merry Christmas.
Well, thanks. Almost ready for it. But
you're never ready for it. Nobody is.
Today should finish things up, yes.
That's it. So, and Corinne brought out a very good thing with that we did talk about yesterday on our New Day program, is that this seminar would make an excellent Christmas present for somebody.
Perfect one.
Yes.
And you're right in your expression by quoting Madison there that knowledge is power, and that's what we need. We need an empowered public. and they can be empowered by coming to this course and learning some things that they'll never learn anywhere else. We've got a whole bunch of information to pass on to them. They're going to learn things that they won't learn from any other Constitution course. So I really encourage people to consider this. It's a great way to spend a Saturday.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We're all looking forward to it as well. And also, before we get going, good morning, Chuck. It's good to have you on board.
Good morning, Bruce. And, Gary, I'm looking forward to seeing you in studio that Friday before for our show.
Yeah.
That'll be exciting as well.
Oh, that was going to be the little surprise I was going to throw in.
Sorry about that. Sorry, Bruce.
There's always one that goes under the tree and shakes the presents before you open it, you know?
It's okay, Chuck. I didn't know that was a surprise either.
Well, you didn't read the memo. That's what you get for missing staff meetings. But, no, Gary will be with us that Friday before in studio live. And so I don't know what you're getting into there, my friend.
one of the big surprises, I think, for people is going to be learning how I teach the Constitution. And that is I've taken a statement by author Gary Wills to heart. He says that to understand any document remote from us in time, we need to first assemble a world around that document. So that's how I approach teaching the Constitution. I first try to assemble this world that existed in 1787 and understand, you know, how that world influenced what we received as the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I've always said, doing a lot of historical research that I do, so many people are quick to condemn the past and how things were done, but to understand the people, the culture, the times that things were done kind of gives clarity in an old document, let's say, and why they crafted what they did. But quite literally, and you can speak on this one far better than I, this document itself, the Constitution, a marvelous thing that to the point where they knew human nature and they included such things in there, knowing that anybody that gets power could get too much power and try to limit, especially in a government mode and that. But it's going to be well worth attending. And if folks miss this one, I don't know. They're missing a good one. They're missing a real good one.
Right.
But let's give them a little example of some of the things and pick up on part two of Life Without the Bill of Rights. Maybe you can recap a little bit what we did, what you also did in your essay. And, we'll get the ship going down, following the trade winds.
Well, certainly. There's a misconception about the Bill of Rights, of course, today, and that is that it is the only thing standing between us and tyranny, and that if we get rid of the Bill of Rights, then we will lose all of these precious freedoms and permissions that we have. But that's obviously not the case, and it's certainly not the case, not the way that the subject of rights was viewed in 1787. There was, in fact, a great discussion about whether a Bill of Rights was even needed, and that the prevailing view was why take the time to list things that the government can't do when we've never given the government power to do them in the first place. So that was one view of why they didn't need to take the time to spell out a Bill of Rights. And the other view was that all but four of the state constitutions then in existence had their own little Bill of Rights, and even the four that didn't, New York, New Jersey, South Carolina, and Georgia, had some discussion of various rights within the body of the Constitution. So the rights of the people would be secured at the state level, so there's no need for a national Bill of Rights. But then generally the view came around that yes, it would be prudent to list these rights that we hold secure so that there's no misconstruction of the Constitution, no misinterpretation of the Constitution itself, and that's how we then got the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to interrupt here for a moment and announce that if you're now tuning in on your radio dial, welcome and good morning. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL. We're licensed in King of Prussia, Philadelphia. You can stream us on 1180WFYL.com on our website, listen live any time of the day, or on your TuneIn app. You can get our podcasts of our previous shows as well as other shows on 1180WFYL.com under our podcast page. And always feel free to email us info@1180wfyl.com and call into this show at any time with any questions for any of our hosts, and we'll try to do our best to answer them, and you can chime in on discussion. Our number is 610-539-8255 or our toll-free number, 877-667-1180.
All right.
And, hey, Corinne, I really appreciate those podcasts myself. I've downloaded every one of them to have a library, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Add to my library of information.
Yeah, and I can tell you, Gary, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. He's an avid listener to this program and doesn't miss it one. Of course, if he doesn't catch, and a lot of folks have realized that they don't catch us live on air or streaming and that, and that's why the podcasts are there. You can go back, and I think that's a good idea to go back, follow the progression, how we're talking about the document.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good tool for learning as well.
Yep.
Now, Gary, in your article, you know, of course, what you just said, you mentioned the fact that, you know, there wasn't any real power given to the government itself, and the Bill of Rights would ensure certain things. But then again, you know, a lot of folks are going, well, wait a minute, you look at it now, they have too much power, and we have a Constitution and a Bill of Rights.
Well, yes, and people need to be aware that they still have a responsibility to guard their rights and speak up when they're being infringed. For instance, if you're a property owner out west, you can't just dig a hole in your backyard and put in a pond without getting permission of the EPA.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are things that the government, there are permissions that the government has usurped for itself without our consent that need to be objected to, and if we don't object to those things, if those usurpations, well, then the government's going to take what it can.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you bring up that story which was in the news about digging the pond in your property and have the Environmental Impact Agency and so forth, you know, jump in there and say, oh, you can't do that. What's talking to legal center with, since it is property, real quick, just take a little side trip on this, Chuck. The right of property ownership.
Well, Bruce, I think that's the foundation or the fundamental concept behind our Constitution is that our founding fathers and the people that came over here on the Mayflower, the people that came to Williamsburg, etc., what they were looking for was not only freedom for their religion, but the ability to own land and do with it what they pleased. And as we've discussed before, months ago, the right to liberty and pursuit of happiness in those days meant something different than what it does today. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to them meant owning land and being able to do what you wanted with it to feed your family and to support the community. It did not mean going out and having a good time on Saturday night. And there's a big difference to that, and people don't understand that. They think that they're somehow entitled to enjoy themselves, whereas our founding fathers were committed to hard work, raising their children and educating them, which is, you know, we've talked about, Gary, and doing the things that are necessary to preserve the family unit and our country. Now, one thing about the pond issue, and two things there. Number one, riparian rights, particularly in the western part of the United States, are very very important. The flow of water and one of the problems we have with Mexico stems from riparian rights. The Colorado River at one point used to be a huge, wide river with water going into northern Mexico. Today, if it's a trickle, that's a lot because the water is diverted to Denver and to Las Vegas and Los Angeles and San Francisco. It gets diverted. And there are a whole series of laws, string of laws about riparian rights and who has the right to use the water, divert the water, etc. And we have taken over that because it originates in our country. And that goes way back to feudal times and when the country was founded and the need for water was so great. And when it continues to be great today. But secondly, with this the EPA and the pond issue, we're facing this situation in my own township where we have two old dams, reservoirs. One is of historic significance from colonial times when there was the old water wheel that ground the corn and what have you.
Part of the mill race.
Yes, very, very historic in nature. And the other one was just one that was put up, not particularly historic, but it provides a lot of, you know, if the people fish there, and if the weather's cold enough, they go ice skating there and what have you. Well, the EPA, and I can't disagree necessarily with the science, but these are artificial dams. They're not dams made by nature or by beavers or what have you. And they've created artificial wetlands and what have you, and they're a hazard in the event of what we call a 100-year storm in the real estate industry, where you have a rainstorm that occurs once a year, such as once every 100 years, such as you would have in a hurricane.
Well, we had that like 2 years ago.
Yeah. And if these are breached, then you have a tremendous amount of water being going downstream and causing havoc and what have you. Well, you've got the EPA on one hand saying we need to breach these dams and let the water flow naturally, and you have the environmentalists saying, oh, you can't do that because the bog turtle will be exterminated from that pond. So now they're at odds over this whole concept. And they can't even get on the same page regarding it. And I feel bad for the bog turtle, but the bog turtle wasn't there till man put up the dam. The dam does provide a whole bunch of resources, and yet by the same token, it's very expensive to maintain. So
Historic significance of the one that deals with a mill.
Exactly.
Mill.
Exactly. Because
the webs we weave.
Exactly. So it's a very complex issue going way back to who has the rights to the water. And the basic principle, just from a real estate standpoint, is whoever gets to it first.
Oh.
Ah, yes. Whoever gets to it first would have the rights. So if you come along later and you divert it, whether it's upstream or downstream, and you're after the fact, but in addition to whoever gets there first, it's whoever has a valid reason for doing it. If it's to water your crops or water your cattle or what have you, that is also a very important factor. You can't just do it for fun or to punish your neighbor downstream.
So therefore, what you're talking about, it almost fits into like a court case, a burden of proof, you know, who has the best evidence.
Bruce, there are countless cases on this, particularly out in the western states.
Yeah. And Gary, you talk about, you know, without a Bill of Rights and about court cases and things that would go, you know, the vision for that. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit to our audience on that.
Well, a lot of what we now have in the Bill of Rights actually has a long, long history in English common law and the English Bill of Rights, 1689. So there's a long tradition, and the colonists in early America were very, very jealous of their rights. They were very insistent on their rights as Englishmen. So the right to jury was established pretty much in 1215 with Magna Carta. And the right to be judged by a jury and not by the king or some nobleman has a long tradition. So if we got rid of the Sixth Amendment, which gives you the right of jury trial, if you just obliterated that from the Constitution, it wouldn't necessarily mean that you would lose your right to a jury trial, because it is a long-established tradition, firmly rooted in common law.
Yeah, well, is it fair to say that today, with the way things are going, if it wasn't in there, you know, the fact that in the old English law, sure, it's there with the trial by jury, but if, and I'm trying to put myself or trying to look at the mind of the framers and the founders of the Constitution, if it wasn't in there, it certainly wouldn't be offered up as an option. In other words, you'd end up with the who tried to assassinate Hitler trials.
Well, certainly our view of the Bill of Rights has changed, and not in a good way. A lot of people see the Bill of Rights as the only thing standing in the way between us and tyranny, and that's really not the case. But that leads to statements like we discussed last week, where you find on the White House website the statement that the Second Amendment grants you the right to mm-hmm. own firearms. Now, that is a misconstruction of the intent of the Bill of Rights. And it's that misidentification, misconstruction that we need to correct. We need to make sure people understand that that their rights are antecedent to the Bill of Rights. They pre-exist to the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And if you take the Bill of Rights away, it doesn't mean the rights go away.
Right. Well, Chuck, that brings up a good question. I always go to you for these on the legalese and the way the words and phrases. Why would they go through and interpret the Second Amendment, for example, what Gary just mentioned, from its actual meaning, put that little twist in it?
Well, as we were talking about before the show, newspeak. We didn't have a budget that was passed. We had a spending bill that was passed.
Yeah, something.
And newspeak, it's the same thing that we see with the liberals saying, we don't have the freedom of religion. We have the freedom of worship. And if you look at the subtlety there, the freedom of worship means, well, if you're in a church, you can worship, mm-hmm. but not out on the street. And there's this subtle tendency to modify our language across the board. Another thing I've seen is we have referred to the Supreme Court of the United States as SCOTUS for many years. Now I'm seeing on TV, now they're referring to POTUS, the President of the United States.
Well, you know, Chuck Schumer said there was three branches of the government, the House, the Senate, and the presidency.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so we're losing a lot with this language thing, and all politicians, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on, use language to their advantage at that particular time. And we've all seen the sound bites and the news clips of a politician saying, I'm for or against this, and then months or years later coming out contrary to it. And on the gun thing, Senator Dianne Feinstein. There is a clip of her from, it's got to be, Gary, you've probably seen it 20 years ago, where she's talking about the Second Amendment, gun rights. I think she even mentions that she has a gun in her house mm-hmm. or something. And listen to her today. So they're just taking this and twisting it around. Now, what are lawyers famous for, Bruce?
Yeah, the list is so long, we only have an hour program.
It's not what you say, it's how you say it. And frankly, and people say, well, and that's where the concept comes of all lawyers are liars. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they're lying, but they say what is allowed under the rules of evidence in a courtroom, and they frame it in such a way that it poses a new perspective. And that's exactly what's happening with our administration today and with our liberal politicians. And I can't say that our conservative ones aren't guilty of it as well. But that's what's happening. And I think newspeak is coming along faster than we can even imagine.
Yeah, well, you know, it certainly doesn't help us when you have people that can't even speak the English language to the point that they're talking in little codes that they use when they're texting. And also the face-to-face communication is something that is few and far between these days. So, you know, I can talk to you quite well when I'm texting, but if I have to look in the eye, I don't have anything to say. But, you know, Gary, your thoughts on the wordsmithing manipulation?
Well, yes, and we have lost a lot of our understanding of the words used in the Constitution. Walk up to someone today and ask them what emoluments are as found in the Constitution, and they're going to say, what?
Yeah, they'll probably end up going down to the local drugstore and asking the pharmacist.
So here's one of the things that people who come to my course on the 10th are going to learn. They're going to learn that they need to understand words in the context in which they were used and in the culture in which they were used. And so how do you find out what these words meant in 1787, 1788, when the document was being ratified? You go to a dictionary that was written at that time, and the best source today is Webster's 1828 dictionary. Now, don't let the 1828 fool you. It was a compendium of language used in America, and the particular American idioms of that English that he compiled over many, many decades. Mm-hmm. So he finally got around in 1828 to publishing it, but really it is the best frame of reference that we have today of how these words were used, what they meant in the time that the Constitution was being ratified. So people should get a copy of that, and it's readily available both in print and online.
We do have to head to a commercial break. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. We'll be right back. Don't change that dial.
All right, thanks for sticking with us through the break here. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL. And we are talking part two of our conversation that started last Friday on what would it be like if we didn't have a Bill of Rights. Now, before the break, we were talking a little bit about verbiage. It always seems to come down to verbiage and how it's been tweaked and how it's been misinterpreted or spun in different ways, and we're trying to get right down to the fabric in which the words that are used in this document, especially in the Bill of Rights, that's the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. And Gary was talking about the 1820 Webster's Dictionary, which is a wonderful resource to understand the verbiage of the past and what it actually means. In fact, those words haven't changed. Those words are still there.
Yeah, and I encourage all of our listeners to call in at any point. We're here until 8 a.m., 610-539-TALK or 877-667-1180. Let us know what you're thinking.
Right. And I want to clarify with understanding the verbiage of the past, which is still very viable today, because the verbiage is there. It's part of the spoken English language. And also in our discussion is something that I'm very adamant on with looking at history. And, of course, this document is history. It, not history to the fact that it's history, but it's history. It was done in history and brought up to now. But to understand the people, the times, what they went through in the past gives clarity to understanding what they wrote and actions they did. And that's kind of where we're discussing and where we left off on that. And Gary, let me ask a question with you. And, of course, a lot of folks are going to sit there and say, well, the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, that's great and fine. But I have a modern-day Webster's Dictionary. Doesn't that work?
No, not at all. Not if you want to understand the Constitution, because our definitions have changed. And the premier example that I always point to is to compare a modern definition of the word education with the 1828 definition of the word education, and you'll see not only how our understanding of the word has changed, but how our culture has even changed in regards to the responsibility for educating children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly. Of course, you know, and that's still evolving, and we can get into a whole thing with that. You know, it naturally comes up the idea of, well, this Common Core type of stuff, and I always say with the Common Core is that we do not have state-run religion, so why should we have state-run education?
And well, that's a good point, a very good parallel. Go ahead, Corinne.
I'm curious. I know last week, Gary, we went through the first five amendments, and then this week we're going through the last five of the first 10 of the Bill of Rights. And I'm curious, do you think that there's one that if we didn't have that is worse than the others? Is there one that we really need to make sure we're doing extra to protect, or are they all, I mean, I know that they're all important, but do you think there's one that sticks out that it's like, if we did not have this, that would really, really cause some disaster?
Well, that's a great question. Which is the most important? I don't know that you could really come up with a final determination on that, but take them in the order in which they were written and the order in which they were listed in the document. And certainly the First Amendment, because of its preeminent place, has to be given great weight. But don't forget the Tenth. I mean, the Tenth is often overlooked because, well, it's at the end of the list, and it doesn't really specify any particular rights, but it is equally important to understand that the powers that weren't given to the federal government were and are retained by the states and the people. So which is more important? Well, I'd be hard-pressed to pick one, but certainly the order in which they were presented was not by mistake. They thought certainly the rights protected and secured in the First Amendment were probably more important than those secured in the Second.
Well, and also with the Tenth Amendment, which we actually play little bits of the Tenth Amendment throughout the day here, and other type of things. But in my opinion, there's a wounding to that amendment, and that wounding came about with the 17th Amendment.
Absolutely. We'll talk about that in the seminar. We'll talk about the 17th and what its real effect was and why it's necessary to be repealed and how best to go about that.
Yeah. Gary, let me jump in for a second. You know, the one thing about the 10th Amendment is if you look at Article 4, basically the 10th Amendment is almost a summary of Article 4, and there's other places in the body of the Constitution itself where that same concept is put forth regarding the sovereignty of each state and of the citizens. And then we go on again in further in the 13th and the 14th Amendments to discuss it even more. And that concept of sovereignty, and I don't think most people, if you took the average person on the street, they couldn't tell you what sovereignty is. Mm-hmm. But the sovereignty of the individual person, the sovereignty of the individual state, and the sovereignty of our United States government has been eroded. People don't understand what that means. And this idea of one world and one state and common core, mm-hmm. The whole idea there is we're all one. No, we're not all one. We are 50 individual states, we are 320-some million individuals, and we have one federal government that is there for a specific purpose, and we've failed to recognize today what that purpose is. It's gone way beyond what it used to be. I have people, you know, from my Conestoga Wood case that still think that employers under the Constitution have the obligation to provide contraceptive and abortifacient contraceptives to their employees. And I don't know where that shows up in the Constitution. Maybe I'm missing something.
Well, they're sitting there arguing the fact with that fits into the, well, even though it's in the Declaration of Independence, that life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness thing. That's what they're going to argue, but it's not a law. That's just simply a letter to the king telling him what to do with it.
Exactly. And they're forgetting what, and Gary, you've mentioned it so many times, the founding fathers, their thoughts, their ideas, their written statements that are there for us to read if the schools would teach it as to how this came about. You know, the Bill of Rights, Bruce, as we all know, were proposed by Jefferson. But in order to get the Constitution established, they agreed that they would defer on that, get the Constitution passed, get away from the Articles of Confederation, get everything in order. And then what's the first thing they did? They came back right away and proposed the Bill of Rights in the form that we see it today and had that passed. I think they started that Congress, that convention in the spring, and by September 17th, they had it done. And then it was ratified. Of course, in those days, it took longer to ratify because they didn't have the communication.
Right.
But it was ratified promptly and without a whole lot of problem.
Yeah, and there's 2 points that you bring up that I want to throw out there to have us kind of go after. As what you were talking about, what we alluded to is that they're referring to other documents such as the Declaration of Independence, Life, Liberty, Pursuit of Happiness. And that brings it right back to that conversation that we had last week where a personal letter to a group of Baptist ministers from Thomas Jefferson talking of the wall of separation of church and state, where they all of a sudden look at that and try to make law that out of a person's personal letter that wasn't even voted on by any. But, you know, you also, with Jefferson, and what Jefferson thought on things, and Gary, you mentioned this as well in your essay, without the 10th Amendment, the idea of nullification. Now, that is something there that I don't think many people realize. And well, if I remember, you know, the how things have gone in law, it's been tried a couple times in federal court, unsuccessful each time, and that's not in recent history. This is over ever since the thing, but nullification, what is nullification?
Well, it springs from the issue that Chuck just mentioned, which is sovereignty. Sovereignty is the concept that you have an entity that has certain inalienable properties. Now, of course, the supreme sovereign of the world is God, and God gives man, or endows man, to use Jefferson's phrase, with these inalienable rights. But men and women have to then give up part of their sovereign power to government for government to have sufficient power to govern. So it is the consent of the governed that gives these powers, these sovereign powers, to government so that it can operate. But we don't give up all of our sovereign power. We give up only enough for government to have the power it needs. And the rest is retained by the people and the states. And this was a big issue in the Articles of Confederation. One reason they were so weak was the states were not willing to give up their sovereign powers to the extent that would enable the central government to operate correctly. So the states still retain a significant sovereign power. And it is that which is being expressed in nullification. When nullification occurs, it means that the state has used its sovereign power to nullify or to declare void a federal act. And the federal act is certainly something, must be something that contravenes a basic right of the state or the people.
Thus, it would be an executive order that the states would step up and say nullification on an executive order such as immigration?
Well, the example most often used in nullification today is gun rights. If, let's just say, for instance, somehow Congress passed a law that that prohibited anyone from owning a gun. Now, obviously, that would contravene the Second Amendment, let's say for the exercise that that somehow happened. Well, the states would, and have already in many instances done so, have passed a law that says any federal law that that prohibits the ownership of guns is null and void in this state. And the state has that power under their sovereign powers concept to do that, and they can say that that federal law is null and void within this state, and no state resources will be used to enforce that law. So the national government can still try to enforce it within the confines of that state, but to do so using only federal resources and not the the acquiescence or the help of the state would be very difficult indeed. So nullification is a statement by the state that a certain federal action is null and void within the confines of that state.
Well, let's talk a little bit of a legal end in here, because nullification has been attempted in various courts, in federal court. But then, let's say if you've got a state that so renders and is bold enough to step up and so render a nullification. And what happens, and Chuck, please weigh in on this one, what happens is then you got, oh, somebody drags it to the federal court, and we've seen so often where federal courts have overruled maybe even something on a proposition in a state in an election that the people, the majority of voters, the federal courts come in and say, well, that's great, you did that, but now you can't do that because we say it's unconstitutional and you don't have authority.
Well, Bruce, the interesting part there is what drives a state to take an action or not take an action. Nowadays, because of the fear of losing federal funding, many states will not take an action. They just say, hey, we're not touching it because we don't want to lose that money.
Isn't that coercion?
Absolutely, it's coercion. It's a very, and I don't think it's a very subtle form. I think it's a very blatant form of coercion. Secondly, you have a judiciary which it's, all federal judges are appointed by the president and approved by the Senate, but you have a judiciary that and sometimes even when you appoint a judge and you think he's politically on your side of the fence, they still make decisions that are coming out of nowhere because their understanding, their knowledge of the Constitution and sovereignty and some of these principles that we've been talking about is not very good. But an interesting point, there was an immigration case, I don't know if you heard about it this week, where the judge, and it had nothing specifically to do with President Obama's recent edict issued from his throne, but it was nonetheless, the judge saw fit, and he was a Bush appointee, to comment in his written opinion on the legality and the constitutionality of Obama's immigration stance. And that right now stands as a federal opinion published in all the legal journals for other courts to look at and comment on. And to my reasoning, my way of looking at it, the reasoning is not flawed. There's nothing wrong with it. It's clear. It's concise. It addresses the Constitution and the separation of powers between the legislative, the judicial, and the executive branch. And I think it's going to set off more and more cases on this, because what people don't realize is that there are immigration judges and federal judges hearing cases every day of the week, and people being deported and people being addressed for many different violations of our immigration laws. And unfortunately, the problem is we've been swamped with immigrants. The courts and can't get to them. The immigration department can't get to them. ICE can't get to them all. But the ones that do, and I think it's an important, I can't say it's precedent yet.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be precedent until it is either left alone, the case is left alone, or it gets to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and not to get too off the track, but Chuck, we did report on that this week when it came across. And however, since it was, you know, and I'll throw this at you, since it was a case that dealt with an illegal that was deported, and he came back, and they caught him, and that's one of the bases of the case itself, the opinion didn't really reflect too much, from my understanding, that ruling on that case, but was kind of injected in there. So therefore, is there a qualification end to the opinion versus this particular case? And okay, that's fine, it's not going to have an effect, or will it have an effect?
Well, Bruce, he used the reasoning of the application towards that case and tied it into President Obama's executive order. And as a result, because of the way he tied it in, and I haven't read the whole thing, but I've seen some excerpts mm-hmm. from it, because of the way he tied it in, you have two issues approached, and they both would constitute an addition to our common law system. It's not statutory, it's not legislating from the bench, but it's commenting on the fact that he doesn't have the power to do that. And that's why the judge made his ruling regarding this immigrant, because apparently he has family and this and that and the other thing.
Right.
The argument was, well, you can't separate us. And he said, well, unfortunately I can, because we have a separation of powers here in this country, and you have to recognize that separation of powers and not rely on executive orders which amount to legislation.
So it sounds a little bit to me that it's federal judiciary nullification attempt.
Absolutely.
So, Gary, there is a nullification there. But when you get to the states, though, and here is the problem, and, you know, here we go. I'm going right back to the infection called the 17th Amendment. And Chuck brings up a very good point with the states aren't going to have the backbone to do that, because that means that sweet little federal money that comes into their coffers might dry up and be used as coercion. Hey, you know, you don't buy our product, you're not going to get, type of thing. And this is an issue.
Well, it is. Anytime there's money involved, it's always a big issue. And the federal government, thanks to our onerous tax laws, has a lot of money to play around with. So it's a big issue, yes. But the states need to realize that they have sovereignty, and they have not only sovereignty but a responsibility to interpose themselves between the federal government and their citizens.
Yeah.
And it's that parallel concept of interposition that runs part and parcel with nullification, that the states need to realize they have this responsibility. They have a responsibility to their citizens. Let's go back to before the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment established the concept for the very first time of national citizenship. Before the 14th Amendment, everyone was a citizen, but only of their own state. Well, the 14th Amendment, when you start establishing this concept of national citizenship, you tend to erode and forget about the concept of state citizenship. You are a state citizen first and foremost, and then you're also a citizen of your country. But the states have forgotten, or tend to forget, that they have a responsibility to their citizens. And first and foremost, they should look out for the rights of their citizens. So nullification should be more prevalent than it typically is.
Well, you're exactly right. You're exactly right.
It's a growing movement.
Yeah, you're exactly right. For example, you and I are kinsmen to the fact that we're both Virginians, but we're Americans.
Right.
Yeah. Chuck?
Well, I wanted to jump in, Bruce. All this talk in recent years about the national identification card. And where does it start? Your Social Security number. Everyone has a Social Security number. They all, the cards you get all look the same. And the talk, though, is to have something with your picture on it that's a national ID so you can get on an airplane
and
go where.
Now you're
going
to disenfranchise people.
Absolutely. So there goes your sovereignty. Now you're a national citizen, and your state sovereignty is right out the window. And they'll tie it into your driver's license, your organ donation, you name it. They'll tie it all in together.
You get your health care.
Exactly. You get your health care, and your Social Security will all be there.
Yeah, now, Gary, you have a statement in your essay here, which, you know, the core of this thing is, and of course, this is going to bring us to what I want to talk about as we're getting here to the end of the program, is under our Constitution, you go on to state, has the authority to identify and define, you know, the rights, the people of the government. And you said that you answered with the document, it is, does it begin with we the people or we the government? Maybe elaborate a little bit on that. Of course, then again, I always joke to the fact that the way things go nowadays, it's basically I the elected official. But elaborate on that and bring people into the fold on you know, why it's good to educate on this. And, gee, you might even want to mention January 10th again.
Well, certainly. The president's powers there. One of the things people will learn in our seminar are the six legitimate powers of the president, and how selectively executing the law is not one of them. Rather, it is faithfully executing the law. So they're going to learn a lot. Yes, but people need to understand that government has no rights except what it has been given by the consent of the governed. And I love the expression that Virginia put in their ratification of the Constitution, where if these rights, if these powers are ever used to oppress the people are going to take them back. Well, that is a powerful, powerful statement.
That
and the people need to understand that they have that right to take back these powers if they're ever used against them.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because you know what? I'd forgotten all about that, and there's an example of why your course is important for new beginners and people that are experienced in this. I had forgotten all about that, and as soon as you said it, I'm like, wow, I knew that, and yet I wasn't even thinking about it. So I want to encourage all of our listeners, whether you're a first-timer or whether you're experienced in these matters, come on out, because the wealth, the depth, the extent, the breadth of information available is just, we only have time on the 10th to touch the surface of what material is there.
That's it. And if I jump in here, what we're talking about as well to wrap up the program is our Constitution seminar that Gary Porter will be conducting at the Conference Center at Valley Forge on January 10th, 2015. Tuition registration is $30 for it until January 4th, and then it'll be $40. Seminar itself will run from 9 to 5:30, but starting at 8, going to 8:50 will be a continental breakfast. Then during the seminar, there'll be a lunch that will be provided as well. And this would make a great Christmas present for anybody in the family to go to. You hear Gary on this program. His wealth of knowledge is just phenomenal. And to register, you want to give Susan Locke a call at 610-539-1783, or you can email her at susan@1180wfyl.com. Well, this is going to bring us to an end for this Friday. Let's see, next Friday we won't be here. We'll be broadcasting probably one of our past programs. And for the Christmas, it'll be our Christmas break that we're doing. But today we've had Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and also Charles Proctor, the law firm of Proctor & Lindsay. I want to thank my co-host, Corinne Lillis. And with all the folks out there, since we won't be next week here, I want to wish you all a Merry Christmas. From all of us here at We the People Constitution Matters. The holiday season's upon us. It's a time to remember those that were with us last year that are not with us this year. It's time to have our thoughts think about our men and women serving in the armed forces overseas that won't be home for this holiday season. If you have such a relative, get a hold of them. Tell them you're thinking of them. This is a time to celebrate the birth of Jesus and the family. And I can't end it any better way. Merry Christmas.